Good morning, I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. What are the educational strategies that lead to real student achievement? What's the optimum class size that gives children a good start on their education? What are the most effective teacher qualifications? What role does a principal play in creating a learning environment? What can parents do to help their children learn? What is meaningful homework? What's the best use of testing, especially high-stakes testing? And what can schools do to reduce the high dropout rate? These are all important questions that are being asked by people who care about schools. A good education provides a solid foundation for the individual and for the larger society. Our guests are with the Center for Public Education. That's a bipartisan initiative of the National School Boards Association, providing information and research-based analysis about elementary and secondary public schools. Patty Barth is director of the center. Jim Hull is policy analyst with the center, and welcome to you both.
It's good to be here, Marty.
Let me begin with you, Patty Barth, and let's begin with class size. We'll put all these questions on the table, get some answers from the two of you. Looking at class size and student-teacher ratio, what is the optimum?
Well, class size is obviously it's very important to teachers and parents both, and we did look at the research. There's been about 20 years of research on class size. What it tells us is that class size really makes a difference for younger children, that is kindergarten through grade 3, and the optimum size there would be 15 to 18. Above that, you don't see the same benefits, so that is really what we've learned most. We've also known that the greatest impact is on children from high-poverty families, low-income families, and minority children tend to benefit the most.
Because they get that more specialized hands-on-hand attention from the teacher?
There's more time, exactly right. There's more time for individual attention. Classroom management doesn't require so much effort. And children are in a happier setting for learning.
And Jim Hull, how many schools or what percentage of public schools have in the lower grades 15 to 18 students per class?
We're not exactly sure exactly what percentage of schools have that optimal class size. It's just very hard to get that data. Most schools, I would think, are in that range. Where the problem usually lies is in the large urban schools, such as Philadelphia, that usually have excess of that size. But especially in the last 10 years or so, these are urban schools like Philadelphia have really improved on the class size, especially for those elementary school levels.
Let me turn back to you, Patty Barth, and just put something else about size and schools. Some have called for smaller high schools where instead of having, say, 2,000 or 3,000 students going to one school, it might be one building, but split into smaller segments within that school. Is that effective?
It is, especially effective when you are trying to improve graduation rates. When students drop out of school, they drop out for academic reasons. We know that children who are failing academically are more likely to drop out, but also because they are not engaged in the school. They feel outside of it. So to prevent that from happening, schools really need to address both issues, both student engagement and making sure that they are academically on track. Smaller schools provide a more intimate environment for doing that. The relationships between teachers and students are better. We also have found out that morale seems to be better both among faculty and the students themselves. And it is a very effective way to keep students on track. And what you brought up there, too, the idea of taking these big buildings, which we know are out there and they're in every district.
Absolutely.
And breaking them up into smaller units doesn't cost that much more. There will be some, obviously, setup costs. Teachers will need some professional development and so forth, but it's nothing like having to build separate buildings to have small schools for high school students.
Jim Hull, I want to talk to you a little bit more about graduation rates and this dropout rate. In Philadelphia, I know in some urban school districts where there are high levels of poverty, There's like a 50% dropout rate in these schools. And we know the world we live in, that the educational needs that people have to have. And of course, this creates a whole host of problems. Looking at schools, what's the best kind of, I guess, when should schools, and do they know the kids, for instance, do they know the kids that are at risk for dropping out?
And actually, they are vastly improving on that, being able to identify potential dropouts very early on in their educational careers. Actually, there was some research done in Philadelphia specifically where by sixth grade, you can predict about 50% of the students who will eventually drop out, and that jumps up to about 80 to 85% prediction rate by the ninth grade. And a lot of the indicators that schools are looking at to have these successful prediction rates are performance and especially attendance rates. Attendance rates are a huge predictor of future dropouts. When kids miss more than 4 or 5 weeks of school, I mean, it's just common sense. You know, they're likely to continue on and be successful in school is highly unlikely. So schools are definitely getting better at predicting potential future dropouts and starting to put into place some programs to help those kids.
Well, I want to ask you about those programs. I mean, if there are kids that are identified at being risk for dropping out, do these intervention programs work? Do they keep kids in school? And Patty Bartha talked about both academic but also interpersonal relationships. Those are two things that can keep a kid connected to a school.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, the interpersonal skills might be the most important part, is looking at what some programs that have been the most successful have been programs where guidance counselors kind of take the lead and keep an eye on the kids and look at attendance rates and look at their academic success. So they're constantly on the button on whether these kids are going to start falling behind and nip it at the bud before they become that potential dropout.
And maybe finding out why these kids are truant, what's keeping them out of school?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's not, you know, one key indicator that's going to be like, ooh, we know exactly what these kids have, you know, they didn't go to class that day. You know, it's not like there's one reason. Yeah, the counselor is really there to find out what's going on and really help the student and the family work together to find out what the problem is and fix it as soon as possible.
And we hear in some schools that you've got one counselor for, let's say, 700 children.
Right. And that's definitely a problem that especially urban districts have been working on. There needs to be more of a focus on getting more guidance counselors and more effective training and resources for guidance counselors. And one of the good benefits that could be going on here, you know, as technology evolves, if you do have to be in that situation where it's one guidance counselor for every 700 kids, if it has to be that way, we're starting to get some data systems in place where the guidance counselor comes in and they just turn on their computer, put on a software program, and their page that just pops up kind of highlights which kids who are absent that day, which ones who might be in trouble, where, you know, you can set it up to where it's where you can have an early warning system right when your computer pops up in the morning, which can be very effective.
Let me turn back to you, Patty Barth, and put something else on the table for discussion, and this has to do with teacher experience, teacher qualification, and if we're talking about achievement, what's the connection there?
Well, we have found out over the last 10, 20 years that when many researchers have studied the effect of teacher, and by that we're talking specifically about the teacher effect on student learning. There are several things that we don't know, but there are things that are emerging. Experience is one. Experienced teachers, that's 5 years under their belt, tend to have better results than new teachers. That makes sense.
Sure.
You know, that jumping into the classroom, the first we all learn on the job. Having academic credentials tends to have a positive effect in the classroom, and that is particularly true in mathematics. So that means a teacher with at least a minor or preferably a major in mathematics is more likely to get better results. Master's degrees, not so much. A small effect, but not a huge effect. Certification, the same thing. Tends to be a better teacher or a more effective teacher, but not a huge effect.
That's interesting. How about things like pay incentives? And there are programs in some districts where, you know, if your students do well, you'll get an additional, you know, $1,000 or $2,000. Does that affect achievement?
We have actually, it's interesting you brought that up because we just looked into that. That's certainly a big issue for policymakers who are out there trying to find good teachers, get them into the classrooms, and they are trying a variety of methods, pay for performance, incentives, some are doing housing incentives. They are very new practices, and unfortunately the research is always behind new practices. So there's not a lot known about that. There is some early suggestion that they are at least successful or having some success at attracting the better qualified teachers into the classrooms, and in particularly in classrooms with the highest need.
Well, that's interesting because one of the findings from your organization was that disadvantaged students benefit more from good teachers than advantaged students. Did I read that correctly?
You did read that correctly, that they certainly do benefit the most. We look at the data, and an effective teacher is going to get the biggest gains from the neediest students. So this is one reason, or if not the main reason, policymakers have been looking into strategies for getting the most effective teachers where they will have the biggest impact.
And we have about a minute before our first break here, but, you know, some classrooms are little islands within a school, and some schools there's a lot of collaboration between classrooms. And I'll toss this back to you, Patty Barth. Is there some research to say which is more effective?
You know, there's really not. There is a lot to suggest that the role of the principal is key to creating a climate where teachers can be successful. Collaboration certainly is helpful, especially if you're a new teacher. We're talking about those new teachers coming into an environment to have mentors around you. We know that can work. In terms of the instruction, not so clear, but there is certainly a lot of evidence that suggests that, you know, this could be a good way to go. But it does get back to the leadership of the principal.
You know, let's take that short break, and I want to talk about the principal after this short break, but let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Patty Barth. She's director of the Center for Public Education. Also with us, Jim Hull. He's a policy analyst at the Center for Public Education. We invited both of them, to join us today on Radio Times to talk about what works in schools, what leads to student achievement. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Act Two Playhouse supports WHYY, a 130-seat theater located in Ambler. Act Two presents Stones in His Pockets. This comedy chronicles the making of a big-budget Hollywood movie in a provincial Irish village. In this fast-paced production, two actors play an entire cast of eccentric characters. Starring Tony Braithwaite and Declan Mooney, Stones in His Pockets, September 2nd through 27th at Act Two Playhouse. Tickets at act2.org, act2.org.
Navigating the world of special education can be a challenge for families. Is inclusion in a mainstream classroom the way to go, or a specialized school? What are some future trends and possible policy changes in the field? I'm Mike and Scott. Join me, Dr. Dan Gottlieb, and guest experts for a panel discussion on special education. This free event takes place on September 16th at 6 p.m. right here at WHYY. For more information, please visit whyy.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What do the Republican and Democratic conventions have in common? Well, the conversation at both has been about a woman. Also, hungry for more politics? We'll talk political books with Steve Almond. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now. today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The Center for Public Education is a bipartisan initiative of the National School Boards Association, and its mission is twofold: to provide practical information and research analysis about elementary and secondary public schools. Patty Barth, director of the center, Jim Hull, policy analyst at the center, both of them joining us today on Radio Times to talk about what works in public schools. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, let's talk about the principal. And Jim Hull, let me get you back in on the conversation. And we have done a number of programs about schools and what works. We've had principals in here. We've had teachers in here, parents and students. And everyone points to the principal and says, this is the cornerstone person in a school. Does the research bear that out?
Research is still unfortunately limited on the effects of principals because it's just so hard to isolate the effect on the head of the school. But almost all the research out there that indicates exactly what you're hearing from parents, teachers, and principals themselves is that the principal has a huge effect on what goes on in the school. What we do see from data, from the research out there, is that teachers teach best and students learn more when they're in a building with a positive learning environment. And almost all the time, that's got to come from the top, from the principal. And there's been many schools that I've been to and that Patty has been to as well, and vastly many others, that you walk into the school, you can feel that positive and that positive feeling, that positive learning environment, and inevitably, you can just look at the data and see the success that they're having in the school. And so, basically, everything really points to really a high quality principal who can get the most out of their teachers and the most out of their students is hugely important to especially turning around schools and getting the most out of their students.
Let me get you to weigh in on this, Patty Barth, because I can imagine different kinds of schools that have, you know, a very proactive and involved principal, but might have very different styles. Has the research looked at the styles to see whether there's one that's a more effective one for learning?
Well, when it has, it's inconclusive. But what does come out is that the principal is supportive of their faculty, that the principal holds high expectations both for students and for the teachers in the school. The positive learning environment, they are focused on learning in the school, not the rules and regulations, although you have to pay attention to that. The bus schedules have to be paid attention to as well, but the primary focus of the school is on student learning, high expectations for all, a belief that not only can all students meet those expectations, but that all the teachers can teach those students as well. So those seem to be the common themes. Now, whether the style, I mean, you can see some are very traditional.
That's right.
Some are very, new
avant-garde.
Age. But as long as they are supportive, everyone's on the same page, they're all working toward better student learning. Came to be the keys.
And let me just toss something back to you, Patty Barth, then we'll get some callers into the conversation. This has to do with high expectations, which I think everyone agrees is important for students and their parents and certainly for teachers as well. But how important is it to have those tools to reach those high expectations, whether it is books or Bunsen burners or any of the kind of technology needed in schools today? Patty?
Oh, listen, resources do make a difference. And we do, obviously the high expectations, if you're looking at principals, teachers, even school boards, that's the number one finding. High expectations is what drives what happens in the school and helps students succeed. But you still have to have those resources. And to say that that doesn't matter is really being a little very short-sighted. We know that books do make having the books in the classroom, having the science lab, we know that that does have a positive effect on student learning, especially in science, obviously.
Sure. I wonder, too, and then we will get to our callers. May toss this to you, Jim Hull, because as we know, the way schools, especially public schools, are funded, it's a mix of federal money and state money, and then, of course, local taxes as well. Mm-hmm. So we do have huge disparities. Some school districts get $5,000, $6,000, maybe $7,000 per student. Some are getting $14,000, $15,000, maybe even $20,000 a student. Now, I realize that richer districts have more money to spend on students nonetheless. Mm-hmm. Has research looked at the amount of money spent per pupil and seen some correlation with achievement?
The research out there is very mixed on the connection between resources and funding and academic achievement. And a lot of that has to do with, honestly, the researchers that are out there.
Oh, is that right?
A lot of that's ideologically driven research, so you can almost, know who's doing the research and what the finding's going to be. But even when you get to that good research on the connection between funding and achievement, when you look overall, it becomes a mixed picture because you have so many good quality, highly financed suburban districts, and they add some money, and it doesn't add too much achievement because they're already achieving very highly. They just want to have that new swimming pool or a little more of the luxuries when it comes to the suburban districts that have that money. But if you specifically look at, the urban schools, the schools that need the most help, that money's going to have a positive impact on achievement. Because as Patty said, resources are important, to make sure that kids have the up-to-date textbooks, that they have the Bunsen burners, the science labs that are taken for granted in a lot of the suburban schools. So when if you look overall, it doesn't look like, the whole country spent so much money on funding, but achievement hasn't gone up. When you look overall, that might hide the fact that, if we invested in our urban and rural schools and gave the teachers the resources they need to maximize their students' achievement, there is more significant gains when you drill down to that level.
Well, and can you speak to that, Patty? Then we'll get to our callers, because that sounds like an argument for figuring out how to increase per pupil funding for urban schools or poor districts.
Well, they need enough. And this is going to vary. All right. That sounds a little flippant, but what they need is an analysis of where that money is going. All right. And that's where the data is so important. There's not a single answer for every community. I have been in urban schools, and I defy anyone to walk into an urban school and say they don't need more money.
Right.
Number one. But when you sit down to get those dollars, you really need to have a good strategy for doing that. Look at the data, find where the need is, and make sure that the resources are flowing where they're most needed.
Which is into the classroom, I'm assuming, as opposed to administration, for instance.
Well, yes, but on the other hand, maybe there is a key administrative function that could help what goes on in the classroom.
So it's not money just alone. It's obvious. I mean, this makes sense. It's where and how it's invested in a school.
Exactly, exactly. And there's not a single answer to that question. You really have to look at your community and your schools and analyze it.
Well, we're talking about today about what research is telling us about student learning and successful public schools. Patty Barth is director of the Center for Public Education. Jim Hull is policy analyst at the Center for Public Education. And we're taking calls here at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Michael from South Philadelphia in on the conversation. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My experience, I joined the New York City Teaching Fellows a couple of years ago, where they pay for your master's in education if you're willing to teach in a urban school for a couple of years, which I was very excited about. But earlier you were talking about how veteran teachers have better results, but what I found in my school was that the veteran teachers were given the classes of the smart, motivated kids, and all the new teachers were given behavior problems and, 19-year-olds taking, freshman math for the fourth time. And it was a very frustrating experience because if I had students that wanted to learn, I could have taught, but I just didn't have that.
But it also sounded like, Michael, that you also didn't have the kind of support that you needed as a new teacher as well?
Yeah, that was also the case. I mean, you're still expected to have a certain percentage of passing students, and when kids can't multiply single digit numbers, it's hard to teach algebra.
Have you gotten out of teaching altogether?
I've taught in a private school, but I doubt I would go back to a large urban environment like that.
For that very reason?
Yes, it was just 85% crowd control and very little even time for instruction. I mean, it was absolute pandemonium.
Well, Michael, let me toss your comment and your experience actually to Patty Barth. And Patty, I mean, Michael's not alone. And this happens, unfortunately, in school districts across the country where you've got well-intentioned teachers who just can't make it in the classroom for a whole host of reasons, as Michael just described.
Right. And, Michael, that's your story. We do hear more often than we really should, and certainly more than we want to. A couple of comments there, and you hit upon this, Marty. You know, the support in the classroom for new teachers is absolutely vital. That we put people in there without a life preserver, and often, as he said, often they're given the most challenging children to work with, and that's just not a way to bring somebody into the profession. If you compare it to business, in the private business world, the most challenging cases are given to the
best, people.
The most proven employees. And the new, the novices are eased into that. We have a tendency in schools to reverse that. And as in Michael's experience, the young teachers, the inexperienced teachers get the challenging students, and those with seniority get the honors students. And we need to think a little differently about how that model works.
And I'm just using Michael's example, then I do want to move on. But also, there was investment in Michael that he was, encouraged to get his master's, and that was paid for, and in return he would teach. But there's that investment of money that didn't pan out, Patty.
Exactly right. And now we do hear this story. Fortunately, in many schools, it does work the way it should. There is support for the young teachers. The principal, again, back to the principal, honors that, makes sure that there's enough there for a young teacher to become a good professional, that it's a badge of honor for a veteran teacher to take the hardest cases and really do something with them and help those children succeed.
Michael, I appreciate the call. Let me get Doug from Brentwood, California to join us. Hi, Doug. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Out here in California, we're trying some creative ways for learning. And my daughter this year is in a combined class. It's, she was going into second grade. And what they've done is it's combined second grade and third graders together into one classroom. And I think it's an effort to raise class scores and challenge certain students. So I mean, it's just kind of I'm concerned that my daughter might get frustrated being in a higher level class. And I was just wondering, is this something that schools around the country are doing?
Well, you know what, Doug?
Combining grades.
Let me find out for you, and I'll toss that over to you, Jim Hull. Have you looked at this notion of this idea of mixing a couple of grades together?
It's actually something fairly new that I have not heard much about at all. I don't think that's happening very too often around the country.
Jim,
usually what kind of goes on is, the more typical what happens is, a student will stick with a teacher for a couple of years, maybe from second to third grade, but not combine two grades together. That's actually something fairly new that I have not heard much about at all.
Patty, I can probably comment on that a little bit. I don't know how pervasive it is. When it does happen, it very frequently happens because of staffing or facility needs, so that there are real logistical reasons to combine classes. Not often does it happen for educational reasons, but that's not to say it doesn't happen. Obviously, it's happening in your daughter's classroom there. couple of things make it work. The ability to individualize instruction, which is good anyway, good practice. Very important to have a mixed level class. A smaller classroom, again, will help that. And professional development for the teacher to make sure that teacher has the bag of tricks to be able to handle different educational needs. That's good teaching practice anyway.
Sure.
I think it comes out a little bit more when you have a mixed classroom at that. My advice to the parent really would be to watch it, talk to your daughter, talk to the daughter's teacher, and just stay aware, keep on top of it. It can be successful. And often is.
Doug, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Yeah. Good luck as well. And Patty, since you mentioned parents, and I know that your organization has looked at the role of parents, and I believe this has been said before, but can you speak to the effect that parents have on their children's education?
Well, parents, of course, are the first teachers. So that's the first effect they have. We know that children do come into school with that achievement gap already present when they come into that kindergarten door. And a lot of that comes from the home environment. The parents who have more time to work with their children, read to them. We all know how important it is to read to your children. Some parents don't have time. They have work multiple jobs and so forth. So that is very key as the first teacher. Throughout the school years, it does help for the teachers and the parents to believe they are on the same page. They know the kid, everybody cares about that child's learning, and that they can work together in partnership. As students go through high school, the role of the parent tends to be less, but still it's important to be involved, be in touch.
And we're about a minute away from our second break. To you, Jim Hull, are there effective strategies to get parents into the schools and connected with schools and teachers and principals?
The research doesn't point to any specific strategies, and it goes back a lot to that principle again, opening up, making the school feel open to the parents. Especially true for urban schools, especially with English language learner population, immigrant populations who might be a little intimidated to go into the school. It's very important for principals to ensure that parents know that it's okay to come into the school. It's okay to contact the principal, the teachers, to make it just an open feeling and make it really truly a community school. There are various ways principals across the country who have succeeded in doing that. And again, it just comes down to personal specific circumstances. But in making sure that the school feels open to the community and the community school is very important.
And that's Jim Hull. He's policy analyst at the Center for Public Education. Also with us is Patty Barth, and she's the director at the Center for Public Education. Both of them joining us today on Radio Times to talk about what works, what the research says about student achievement and good public schools. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Coming up, we'll talk about homework, the school day, and much more. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education offers fall art classes and workshops in drawing, painting, sculpture, printmaking, and more, conveniently scheduled during evenings, weekdays, and weekends. Featuring courses for high school students on Saturday mornings, a master class with Peter Saul in November, and a critique with Stuart Shills in December. For details, 215-972-7632 or pafa.edu.
I'm Greg Cott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Jim DeYorgatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times. Together we host Sound Opinions, an hour of music news, reviews, interviews, live performances. Basically, the two of us sitting on the couch with you, covering the world of music.
We also rate new CDs on our patented scale. Buy it, burn it, trash it. It's Sound Opinions, the world's only rock and roll talk show.
Monday nights at 10, starting September 8th on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day.
California has a long history of inspiring songwriters.
This summer, it inspired some new ones.
California, the sun will shine on me again.
the winner of our California Dreamin' Song Contest.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And today on the show, we're talking about educational strategies that can lead to student achievement. We've been talking about class size and teacher qualifications, the role that principals play, parents as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And our guests are Patty Barth and Jim Hull from the Center for Public Education. Let me get Matthew from Ewing to join us. Matthew, go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Hi, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I am an educator at the college level, and as a graduate student, I had worked with Philadelphia Public Schools through a National Science Foundation program where we would come in for several hours a week and work with the students in math and science through engineering. And what I observed over the 2 years I was involved in that program was that in many cases, teachers felt hindered or hampered by the rigid curriculum that's set out for them. You know, for instance, they have a book that says, on this day, at this time, this is what I'll be teaching. And it seems like, you know, we had great success in our program, but it required that we would work with teachers who would, you know, have some degree of flexibility in what they taught in the classroom and how they presented material. And I was just wondering if the guests had any comment about the success of these very prescribed curricula that have come out recently in response to a lot of things, but things like No Child Left Behind and that sort of thing.
It's a good question, Matthew. I'm going to toss that to you, Patty Barth.
Yeah, sure. It's interestingly enough, the studies that have been done on a lot of the prescribed curricula do show that they have a benefit. And again, especially in urban areas. Now that, remember, we are looking at the averages.
Right.
And again, we'll go back to the novice teacher. Sometimes as a novice teacher, you're learning classroom management while you're trying to help students learn a lesson or a concept. This can be very helpful to have a prescribed curriculum there. That is one thing that you don't really have to develop on your own while you're learning all of these other practices. Now, for a veteran teacher who is proven and so forth, you don't need that. And that could be some of the frustration you encountered when you went into the school. So it's, again, I'm going to go back to looking at the data and helping teachers look at their own practices and look at their own students' achievement. And where it works, use it. If you don't need it, let that professional go and do what he or she knows is working, and have the data to back it up.
Just following up on Matthew's question, though, if and he mentioned No Child Left Behind, and he also mentioned this rigid curriculum that he saw. But is that a kind of a byproduct of the pressure and even the focus now on testing and high stakes testing? Can I toss that back to you, Patty Barth?
Sure. There has been, for even leading up to No Child Left Behind, across the country, there was an emphasis on standards-based outcomes, meaning looking at results rather than what courses are required or what curriculum is required, is to really establish what it is you want children to learn and then make sure that they're learning it. And that shift has brought a whole focus on a lot of things like testing, like a curriculum that is aligned to the state standards.
Right. And teaching, too. I mean, the criticism, and there are a number of them with No Child Left Behind, is that it has forced schools and teachers to teach to the test because so much is riding on the results.
Well, teaching to the test is, there are a lot of ways to think about it. And when people generally talk about teaching the test, they're talking about a very narrow focus on memorization, on perhaps test-taking skills. And we know from surveys of teachers, of principals, that this is happening. It's unclear how widespread those practices are, but we know it is happening. And the pressure from No Child Left Behind and these other state accountability mechanisms has heightened that pressure. On the other hand, another way of looking at that question is from the reverse side, which is what teaching practices produce better results on the standardized tests? And here the research is pretty clear that teachers who have a curriculum, maybe not a rigid curriculum, but make sure that the curriculum is aligned to the state standards and make sure that the students are focused on critical thinking, the higher order thinking that educators like to talk about, and that it's a very rich learning experience. Those students tend to do better on the standardized test than their peers in classrooms where the teacher did the test prep, looked at the skills, emphasized the memorization.
So a rich curriculum, as you describe it, that is tied to a test can actually lead to student achievement.
Yes. Yes, this is what the research says. Is this happening? I don't know. There is an atmosphere of fear out there. Sure. And it's hard to deny that. And I guess if I could talk to everyone, I would say, please, relax, you're professionals. Know what you need to do. Make sure your curriculum is aligned to the standards. But, you know, teach the students the way you know that they need to be taught, and they will do better.
Let me toss something else out here, and I'll toss this to you, Jim, and then we'll get back to our callers, a wholly other topic. Mm-hmm. This has to do with the length of the school day, even the length of the academic year. There was a report recently in the Philadelphia Inquirer looking at hours in school per week. South Korea, 30 hours per week. The United States, 22.2 hours per week. More time in the classroom, more time in schools, does that lead to more learning?
Not necessarily. If you do increase time, it has to be done, you have to use that time correctly. Too many times what we see in the research is that you're extending the school day or the school year, you're still, the teachers and instruction is still acting the same. There isn't much change, so they're actually, not much use goes into those extra hours and days. But if you specifically, you know, get quality professional development on using that extra time correctly and efficiently, there are some results. And internationally, actually, you know, South Korea does have some more instructional. South Korea has some more instructional time, right. But most other countries, we're all about the same. If not, the U.S. has actually has more instructional time than a lot of other countries, but which does not necessarily lead to other countries outperforming the U.S.
I hear you. Let me get to Elizabeth from Fairmount to join us. Elizabeth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was formerly a teacher in a rural school district, and my question is there any research that shows what would happen to the teaching profession if teachers were required to have training like lawyers and doctors go through years of training? It's very rigorous. I'm wondering if there's any research about that.
And are you saying, Elizabeth, in this rural district there wasn't that kind of professional rigorous training?
That's what I'm saying. I mean, I didn't feel that a lot of my colleagues, I mean, I loved the town that I lived in. It was a wonderful place, but I didn't feel the sort of professional rigor that maybe existed in some other professions.
Let me toss it over to Patty Barth. And Elizabeth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Patty?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yes, and the actually the field of education research is getting much better about learning what is needed to produce better prepared teachers. There are two ways to look at it. There is the initial preparation itself. So the universities obviously have the biggest role there in how they train those teachers and put them out in the classroom. But the other part of it that the caller just referred to is ongoing professional development. And I think any of your listeners, if they think about their own jobs, know how much they change from year to year to year. And teachers, certainly, it is very true. And so the initial preparation is just part of it. Teachers, like any professional, need to keep up with what's going on in their field, staying up to date so they can continue to be effective.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get to Rebecca from Doylestown in on the conversation. Hi, Rebecca. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if the guest could comment on, in terms of the role of the principal, the idea of something that's happening in my daughter's school, which is a fairly new principal wants to keep teachers fresh by switching them to different grade levels. I think we have about 54 teachers, and this year more than half of them have been switched to a new grade with new teacher teams.
And that would be, I mean, is that a dramatic shift, or is it from one grade to another?
All from one grade to another, yes. And some of them, well, I mean, there are second grade teachers going to sixth grade, right. Fifth grade teachers going to third grade. I know of a favorite kindergarten teacher who's been teaching kindergarten for years and years and years is switching grades. And I just wondered if there is really the idea that, you know, by rearranging the curriculum, you can get more out of a teacher.
It's a good question. Let me toss that first to Jim Hull. Jim, have you looked at that?
I haven't looked specifically at that, but that would definitely be something, as a principal, I wouldn't rush into, and that should definitely be a concept that would have to be discussed with your teaching staff pretty much in depth. Reason being, you know, sometimes some teachers are very comfortable in the grade that they're in. They're familiar with, you know, the instructional practices of that grade and are very comfortable and constantly want to upgrade their ability to teach at that level. But there is, I can see the understanding that, you know, some teachers get bored at the level that they're at, you know, because there's not enough, you know, there's not a professional career ladder like in many other most other professions, where you can kind of, you have a goal to progress and things are kind of new every year. So some teachers do get bored at the grade level that they're at, so changing grade levels could be a good way of retaining your best and brightest teachers there and keeping them teaching to the best of their ability. But you don't want to do that if that's going to upset them. So it's definitely something that would be depends on the circumstances within the school itself, but I wouldn't take it lightly just going right in and trying to
kind of wholesale rearranging of teachers. Rebecca, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Patty, I've saved the best for last, and this is homework.
Everyone wants to know about homework.
Exactly. We could do a whole hour on homework. I'm just going to give you a couple minutes here, and then we'll get one or two callers on before we have to say goodbye. What is meaningful homework?
What is meaningful homework? Well, homework is meaningful for middle and high school students, mostly high school students. Elementary kids, and this is where I tell you, we take calls from parents, I think, every day.
I'll give out your phone number at the end of the hour. No, go ahead, Patty.
Yeah, okay. Elementary school, a little bit of homework may be beneficial, but you can certainly hit some diminishing returns with too much. A good rule of thumb, 10 minutes added for each grade level. So that'd be 10 minutes at first grade, 20 at second, and so forth.
And what about it at the high end? And you hear from high school students in particular, sometimes middle school students, that they're doing 2, 3, 4, 5 hours of homework a night?
We are hearing that. On average, American students don't do that much. On average, American high school students are only doing about an hour.
Okay.
But we hear certainly anecdotally of kids who are doing many, many more hours of that. Good rule of thumb, high school level, 90 minutes, no more than 2 hours, but up to 90 minutes, that's a good thing. So you kids out there, do your homework.
Where were you when I needed you? But what about, and there are parents, you know, hovering over their kids doing their homework. Have you looked at the research on that?
Well,
or is there research on
you
that?
You get more impact if the kids do it themselves.
So hands off.
You know, and for younger kids, it might be good just to develop that habit, all right? Little bit of homework, but you certainly don't want to overburden elementary students.
And have you looked at homework and watching television and text messaging and talking to your friends online, which many students do as well?
We haven't looked at that, but you know what? I think that's the world that we all are living
yes.
with. I have my email up now while I'm talking to you. I shouldn't admit that, but
I caught you.
Yes.
Let me see if I can squeeze one more caller on. Brian from Reading. We're almost out of time here, Brian, but spit out your comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess my comment would be a lot of the discussion around teaching and standards always seems to be around the teachers and what they can do more and so on. And I have two parents that are retired teachers. My wife is a teacher, lots of friends and so on. And I don't think there's enough emphasis on the responsibility of the students and the responsibility of parents. Too often it seems the parents always interject and say, well, Johnny's got football practice, you can't give him too much homework and stuff. So I think, I don't think there's a respect for education. We want the standards, but we don't want it to get in the way of turning off the television or taking the phone away from them and so on.
Right.
And that's really the parents' responsibility.
Well, I think that's a good point and probably a good place to end the show as well. Jim, do you have any quick comment to what Brian is saying? Make sure the focus also stays on students and their parents.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely important to ensure that, you know, parents stay on top and do their job to make sure that their students succeed. They definitely have a significant role to play in that. But the government can't control parent action. The focus is on what schools can do, and we can, the government and, policymakers can encourage parents to be more successful at improving their students' performance. But, there's only so much the government can do at that end. But, the focus on improving what schools maximize the effect that schools can do for each student is still very important.
Brian, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Jim Hall, Patty Barth, thanks for joining us today as well.
Thank you, Mark.
And Patty Barth, Director at the Center for Public Education, Jim Hall, Policy Analyst at the Center for Public Education, both of them joining us today on Radio Times to talk about what makes for a quality education. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Leave us an email. Find out more about the program, including things like podcasts. I'm Marty Moss. Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. And do stay